Welcome to the Big Beatles Sort Out, a show in which I, author and musician Gary Abbott, attempt to finally decide my favourite Beatles recordings by scoring each and every one for lyrical content, musicality and production, assisted by my brother and resident Beatles expert, Paul Abbott. Each episode we explore and score five songs pulled at random from the Beatles' full recording catalogue. Thanks for joining us as we try and sort out the Beatles. Welcome to episode 27, and welcome to The Space Between Us, Paul Abbott.
Hello, everyone.
You all right?
I am all right, thank you. I was trying to think of something exciting and Beatlesy that I've done recently, but I haven't really done anything because I can't go anywhere or do anything.
Oh, never mind. You do live in the...
So, sorry about that.
That's okay. You live in the home of Beatles, so, you know.
Yeah, I do get to walk past lots of Beatles places every day if I go out for a walk, so
yeah,
that's nice anyway.
Yeah, good stuff. Don't forget, you can keep in touch with us at @big_sort on Twitter and on Instagram, or by email to bigbeatlessortout@gmail.com, and please do drop us a review or like, share, tell someone about us on your social media so that we can reach more people. That's really all we need from you. Yeah, I've also got links in the podcast description to an ongoing music project of mine called Bag Ratty Bro, and by now there should be a single called Crushing Eggshells available to listen to on Spotify and all those kind of platforms, so it'd be great if you could check them out too. Paul, have you anything you'd like to tell our listeners about this week?
Well, by the time this episode goes out, I will have started recording the next season of the Head Ballet podcast. Ooh. My novelty song podcast. Those will be coming out as and when this time, rather than on a rolling 10-day or fortnightly basis, just to try and help keep me sane between that podcast, this podcast, and my Ed McBain podcast as well. But yes, so they'll keep an eye on that. We'll put links in the usual places to those when they start coming out as well, and you can have a listen to that. That would be nice.
We sure will. Well, the first season is, and that podcast in general is linked in the description, so do check out the existing episodes too.
Yes.
So, Paul, let's start with On This Beatles Day, which I think should be the 29th of March.
Yes, it should.
Which, yes.
That's today to people listening to it on the day that it comes out, or it's just another date to anyone else. Mm-hmm. It's the 29th of March, and I've chosen 1962, because in terms of actually what I was saying before, but walking around Liverpool, living in Liverpool is an interesting thing, because obviously you've got some big headline Beatles places, of which the Cavern is, you know, obviously the main one. Then you have like the National Trust houses, and then there's a few other bits and pieces that are either to do with them or have been brought in since, you know, like the statues down the front and that. But what I've done is I've picked the 29th of March 1962 because that's the date where it's the first of two times that the band played at a place called the Odd Spot Club. And that's on Bold Street in Liverpool. So Bold Street is... in the city centre, it's a sort of sloping street down from the bombed-out church into the centre of town, and it's got lots of cafes and restaurants on, and the Odd Spot Club was on Bold Street. It is now, the building that occupies that space now, it's the same building, but the business that occupies that space is called Bold Street Coffee. But in the basement of the Odd Spot Club in 1962, 29th of March, Beatles played there for the first time. So this is pre-Ringo.
Okay.
And... why it's an interesting and significant date is because it is the first time that they wore their suits.
Ooh.
So Brian Epstein's got involved. They've gone off and they've sort of talked about these suits. They've put their ideas in for what they'd like. They've had them tailored, and this is their first gig in the suits. I mean, the big launch of the Beatles in their suits was in the Cavern.
Okay.
But this was like the first gig where they were playing their suits.
A soft launch, as it...
yes, I suppose in modern parlance. And yeah, there's some photos from there. A guy called Alan Swerdlow, who Brian asked to take some pictures, but they're not brilliant because, I mean, it's a basement venue. There's no particular place where you could get the lighting's not great. You couldn't get a good position, all that sort of stuff. But there's some interesting little photos from that day. But it's an interesting little moment. You know, it's another venue in Liverpool that most people won't have heard about. But if you go to Liverpool, go to Bold Street Coffee, and you'll know you'll be standing above where they performed on that day. And I'm pleased to say I have performed in Bold Street Coffee for an acoustic thing for someone's exhibition launch, because they often have pictures up on the wall from local artists, okay, or whatever. And we were asked to play once in my band, so me and my bandmate Will did a little acoustic session there. So I can say that's another place I've played, technically, where the Beatles have played, you know, grasping at straws. But anyway, 29th of March, Odd Spot Club, first outing of the Suits.
Brilliant, brilliant. And is the actual basement part of that open, or is that...
No. I don't believe so. I'd be very interested to see if there's any evidence down in the basement of how it was decorated when it was the club anything like that. But I suspect it won't be.
Well, you never know.
You never know.
These things happen, don't they? People just don't use rooms and they haven't really used them for years. And
true.
Go down there and find four discarded first original ever Suits.
Yeah.
That'd be nice. Great. That's cool. Well, when we can come to Liverpool again, Paul, you'll have to take...
Well, we'll do a tour.
We could podcast a tour episode, Paul, couldn't we? We could do a walk around.
Maybe we could. I'll try and pick up some interesting places.
Well, that's something to think about. So let's get on with the show. And the first song up is Think For Yourself. You're telling your old lies about the good things that we can have if we close our eyes. Do what you want to do and go where you're going to. Think for yourself, cause I won't be there with you. Think for yourself, Paul.
You sound like a conspiracy theorist. Wake up, sheeple.
Well, that's anyway. It's kind of what is that what George is saying? I don't know.
I don't know. We'll talk. Yeah. So, Think for Yourself is obviously, it's a George Harrison album track from Rubber Soul. Comes out on the 3rd of December, 1965. It was recorded on November the 8th, 1965. Worth mentioning as well, it appears on the Yellow Submarine song track, which came out in 1999 when they re-released the film. And even though actually in the film it's a tiny, tiny snippet of them rehearsing the backing vocals, they ended up putting it onto the Yellow Submarine song track album as well, which is nice because it's an interesting song to have it in a different place. But yeah, like I say, it's a George song, famous for its fuzz bass. Interesting stuff.
It is, yeah. I love it, especially from the kind of relentless fuzz bass to the awesome harmonies that you've just mentioned, the snippet that appears in Yellow Submarine, to the kind of dark, jaunty chorus and George's kind of wise snarl throughout, plus the stabby chords on the organ that are kind of rhythmic all the way through, and Ringo's great rhythm, which is only slightly ruined by the level of the tambourine going throughout it. But what I really like about this one musically, it's kind of a proto mold of those kind of bands that come along a lot later, I think. Maybe not. There might be some I don't know about. They get by with a little more than just a bass and drums, you know, like the White Stripes and whatnot. You could strip this song down to those two fundamental parts with the voices.
Yes, there's not much going on in terms of, like, there's no solo stuff in it. There's no twiddly bits on top of it. It is just a sort of... you could do it like a sort of monolithic remix where you just get it pounding through bass and the fuzz bass.
Absolutely. And I'm sure someone must. And those kind of bass drummer bands, I reckon someone must have done this by now. I have to look it up. Although there's kind of a fuzz line and there isn't not just fuzz bass, is it? There's a fuzz bass and a bass.
Yeah, so there's a clean bass and then there's an overdubbed fuzz bass as well, which for anyone who doesn't know is essentially, I think in this instance, you can get fuzz in a lot of different ways. So it's like, it's akin to distortion. You can get into all sorts of differences about what is fuzz and what is distortion and what is overdrive and all that stuff. But in this case, I think what we've basically got here is McCartney plugging into a device, a pedal, a box to make it fuzzy, and they've overdubbed that. Quite why, I don't know what would have led to that, really. It's
a good thing to have done.
Normally you'd have one or the other. You'd have normal bass or fuzz bass, or you'd have bits of it in fuzz, bits of it in normal.
Yeah.
But in this, you've just got this sort of weird... And plus, it's in the stereo mix, it's spread right and left.
So
almost they're isolated from each other.
It's taking the place of the guitar almost, isn't it? And
because the guitar's not very noticeable in this.
No, I didn't even notice. It's so not noticeable that I didn't notice it, Paul.
Yes, well, there you go.
Yeah, But they're different. They're not just the clean bass line doubled up and one channel having a fuzz on it. It's, so it has got an interesting... well, they're more or less the same. It is interesting that those choices, which we're kind of getting into production, but they're kind of wound up because that the musically, that fuzz bass pushes it along so much anyway. Yeah, but having said that, the harmonies in this are really lovely as well. They're a massive part of it, aren't they? And so if you did have your kind of duet on stage, drums and bass, you'd need at least both of you singing and probably a third person too,
yeah,
to get that same effect. I think the music's really good. It's quite simple, but it's really good for what it is. I'm going to give it 65 for music.
Yep.
So production, we kind of already dipped.
Oh, tipped.
We've tipped over. We've tipped over into production. That works.
Oh, there you go. Well done. Well, yeah. Good save.
But I just love how every episode and almost every song, there's always a feature to talk about. Given their catalogue runs to over 200 songs, it's amazing, really, isn't it? You know, nearly every song you're like, oh, this is the one with the or that, and you can't believe they did that so many times. And am I right in thinking that this is one of only maybe two Beatles songs that use a fuzz bass effect on them? So prominently, at least.
Well, you know how we talk about episodes having themes?
Well, yes.
Sometimes. Well, you know, maybe let's leave that hanging in the air.
Okay.
As a thing. But it's certainly the first significant use of fuzz bass, which, it's an interesting production decision as much as it is a musical decision. Because much of this song is driven by the rhythmic aspect of it.
Yeah.
Which is interesting because it means Ringo gets to do some interesting stuff and then they stick the maracas and the tambourine on as well, which obviously you're saying is you find quite intrusive. But, I find it baffling that they haven't... Because normally, if you record two channels of one instrument, whether it's an overdub or literally you split the signal, you'd normally combine them together. The reason you do it is to try and get a bit...
A thicker balance
options, you know, so you can push it up a little bit here or there. But here, like I say, this in the stereo at least, it's panned way across.
Yeah.
So you've got these very identifiable individual bass lines doing more or less the same thing, occasionally slightly little performance differences. But it's interesting.
It is interesting. And I think the takeaway from it is that it's interesting and it works for this song, but they don't really, apart, you know, maybe later on they use fuzz again, but they're not in this way. And I don't think it's because it didn't work. I think it's because they approached every single song with what does this song need? And were almost like they were starting with everything they'd learned to that point, but they didn't just go, oh, that's great, we'll do it again and again and again, like so many other bands would and do to this day. Yeah, it's great. The rest is okay. They've obviously decided, I thought they decided against any other guitars, but as we've already established, I just didn't notice what was in there.
Yeah, there's sort of a rhythmic guitar part in there as well, but nothing prominent particularly.
Oh yeah, no, it's just doing a quick stab kind of note chord, isn't it? And then there's an organ playing on the kind of beat.
So that's Lennon sort of doing playing, that rhythmic
playing
organ.
Eighths or sixteenths or something, just playing all the way through. And then I say just the slightly over-enthusiastic flabby tambourine sound, which sometimes it's not just all tambourines because we definitely have had weeks where I've said, oh yeah, that works, but you know, it's one way.
You seem fairly down on the tambourine in general.
Yeah,
I'd say you moan about it more than you praise it.
Yeah, I think. On balance, I don't like the tambourine as much.
Okay.
But it just seems to always be a bit too high for me. I like it when it blends in with everything else and you go, oh, yeah, there's a bit of tambourine in there. Not, oh, some tambourine. But anyway, it doesn't distract much from the great fuzz bass and those beautiful, drawn-out, slurry harmonies, the way that they sing them, the way that they kind of... move from one word to the other and draw them out.
Talking about how delivery of words and music, this is a great one for George being a Scouser.
Oh, yeah.
Isn't it? The.
Yeah.
It's full on, you know, Scouse George in this, which is always great fun.
Yes, and I'm going to give Scouse George 69 for production. Okay.
Can I just say before we move on to that, there is, if you listen in the left-hand channel of the stereo mix, about a second and a half in, there's a little crackling noise that shouldn't be there, but is like a cable fizzing, or something like that. And that's my little tiny production note.
We should have had a whole section for you. It's a bit too late now in the day, isn't it? Where you've got to say about squeaky bass drum pedals and wire crackles.
Yeah, we get them in there one way or another.
Yeah, you could put together you need to put together kind of a playlist of like 2 second snippets of all these things. That'd be great. Okay, on to the lyrics then, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
So this always confused me somewhat because it sounds like George berating, talking down to the kind of the teachings of exactly the kind of person and way of going about things that he would soon kind of be beholden to. I don't know if it's just a, because it doesn't really mean much this, but it's kind of like he does a full 360 after this song. So I'm not to say that he didn't want to think for himself, but he went to seek teachings from a guru who was saying, like, yeah, you know, you can achieve all these things through, you know, meditation and closing your eyes and in your mind. And I don't know, is it, what is he rallying against in this? Because it's funny.
Well,
I
think it's, I don't know, there's not much evidence as to what he was really thinking about from this. And if you go to his book, I, Me, Mine, this is included in there. And his comment for this is basically, well, I can read all of it. Mm. Think for yourself must be about somebody from the sound of it. But all this time later, I don't quite recall who inspired that tune. Probably the government.
Right.
And that's all he's had to say about it. And you can't really find anything else anywhere. No one else has got any revelations or thoughts.
Yeah. It's just because he says, you're telling all those lies about the good things that we can have if we close our eyes. It sounds like he's talking about someone peddling kind of faith or meditation, exactly the kind of thing. It's what it sounds like, just that construction of those, that sentence of those words. It doesn't sound like he's saying...
It could be the opposite. It could be someone lying to say, you can't... Look, meditation's rubbish. You can't have this. You can't close your eyes and get great things. That could be the lie, couldn't it?
Yeah.
You can receive it either way.
But then he says to think for yourself, which sounds like the person is saying that you should think like them, which I don't know. It's a hard one, but basically...
It feels very George, though, doesn't it? Yeah. He's like he says, he's clearly got someone or something in mind while he's doing it.
Yeah,
it might just be that he's trying to resolve his growing philosophy, personal philosophy, as this period is happening, you know, with the world around him and all the things that take up your day-to-day life, such as tax men and relationships and all those sorts of things.
Because there are bits of this which sound like possibly a typical breakup rejection song as well.
Mm.
So I'm not sure what's going on. I don't know whether it's because George has got a kind of mystical slant to what he's writing anyway, so it starts to kind of fuse in and sound like you're so used to expecting him to be talking about something like that. Well, he's either talking about money or God, isn't he? So, but anyway, the line, have you got time to rectify all the things that you should, is pretty cool and sounds awesome with those harmonies.
Some great words in there.
Yeah. Yeah,
your mind's opaque.
Yeah, yeah, it's great. And you sent me a cool clip of some of them kind of bantering as they were practicing all these harmonies.
Oh, well, this we must recommend this. If anyone's not listened to it, there's a quite widely available, and it's easily found on YouTube from the rehearsals for the vocals for this session, where they left the tape running deliberately, I think, because I think possibly it was to do with them. They were prepping for the Christmas thing, so George Martin left the tape running just in case something funny came out of it.
Yeah.
But you've got all this massive lump of studio chatter, and it's brilliant. They're just so silly,
yeah,
and so funny and so daft, and it's just such a great listen. It's my favourite bit of Beatles studio chatter.
Yes, it's very good. Okay, so I'm not sure if I said, but I'm going to give it 63 for lyrics, which gives it 65.7 overall. Okay?
Yeah.
Right then. Next, we have Mean Mr. Mustard.
His sister Pam works in a shop. She never stops. She's a go-getter. Takes him out to look at the Queen. Only place that he's ever been. Shout out something obscene. Such a dirty old man.
Mean Mr. Mustard, Paul.
I can't think of anything. Medium Mrs. Cranberry Sauce? I don't know. That was too hard to think of one.
Oh, very good.
Okay. Abbey Road. Part of the Abbey Road long medley. This was recorded in tandem with Sun King. So the session was Sun King and Mean Mr. Mustard. Obviously, Abbey Road comes out in September of 1969. This was recorded on the 24th, 25th, 29th of July of that year.
Mm-hmm.
A weird little Lennon number. It's, as we've discovered, doing these ones from the medley in isolation is a bit of an odd thing. You know, talk about, especially with this one, talk about, you sort of get somewhere and you're really anticipating what's coming next once you know.
Mm.
And it doesn't come.
Yeah.
It's a strange one. But yeah, it's the origins of this are very interesting. But what was our theme? Our theme so far was fuzz bass.
Yes.
And here we are with the other one with fuzz bass on.
Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, I realised asking that earlier on didn't really make sense in the course of the episode. Are these two the only fuzz bass ones that we can think of? Can you think of any other fuzz bass ones then?
I think they might be the only two with deliberate, like, getting a fuzz pedal and using it for, like, exaggerated effect. You know, because you can overdrive and things, like a normal bass signal, which you would do in certain circumstances. But off the top of my head, I think so, yeah.
I mean, it's slightly distorted on things like Helter Skelter, but that's more just absolute volume, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's distortion. I mean, this further proves that the random pick has become self-aware. of all the songs, we have the two fuzz bass songs coming right out after each other. I mean, what are the chances of that, eh?
I don't know.
No, what are the chances of that?
I don't know. I don't know numbers.
I don't know either. I tried to look it up and gave up. But anyway, yeah, so here we are with the good old side B of Abbey Road dilemma. You know, this comes just before Polythene Pam, which then leads into Bathroom Window. So for me, like you've just said, they're all, those three I've always placed together. And yeah, it is weird. You hear the ring off. You hear the beginning of the one on the last, you know, it does feel like we've taken a complete chomp out of the middle of something, really. But then they decided to kind of track them like that, didn't they? And list them like that.
And they record them in little groups. So this is, this is so unlike Sun King, but this was recorded in the same session as Sun King, which comes immediately before it. But I never put Sun King with Mean Mr. Mustard. I put Mean Mr. Mustard with Polythene Pam in my head because that feels like the little story in the middle.
Yes, indeed, yeah. But it's short, but it makes an impact considering it's so short. You know, I think of it as a distinct song, even if it is so tiny. It has an impact with its daft fuzz bass and its stomping piano chords and its feel. It's a great melody and harmony and lots of little guitar accents going on.
Yeah, interesting Ringo delivery in the vocal as well. He's sort of doing a character voice, but still being Lennon.
If that's a production thing to talk about as well, I don't know. You'll be able to tell me. I've got a question for you. So Ringo's Brill, as always. It's a good song, but there is only a minute 20 or something of it, so I'm going to give it 55 for music. So on to production then. My thought with the vocals is it's one of these kind of weirdly slowed down ones or something.
Right.
Do we know if it is? Or
I don't believe it is, no.
Because it's got that feel. It does sound like you say, he's doing a voice or something that's making him, we've got this real resonance, a throaty resonance. It might just be that he was in that kind of voice that day and he was using it the best he could.
Yeah. He's deliberately choosing a manner in which to sing it.
Yeah, it's great the way he does it, though. It's a real kind of gravelly voice, but in a cartoony way.
It is, because it's like he's telling a cartoon tale of this eccentric character.
Yeah.
You know, and I just think it's a good decision musically for him to do it that way. It's actually, when you're listening in isolation, what I found was it's not quite as frantic and mad as I think of it when I'm thinking of it as part of the medley. On its own, it's not chill exactly, but it's not quite as harsh and thumping as you might imagine it to be.
No, it's quite downbeat in some ways, and it's got what would you call that kind of dum 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 dum? Is it kind of two step or something?
It's like a weird march, isn't it?
Yeah, it's cool. But it's got a nice little groove for itself. But obviously the fuzz bass is the big other feature in it.
I'd had in my mind for years That was actually not a bass, but the Moog. Because you could make a sound like that on the Moog. Mm. But of course it is a bass, and when you listen, it has got bass performance things in it. You can hear at one point, I think you can sort of hear him slide up the frets a little bit and things like that. But I'd always just, I don't know why, because I'd never seen any evidence to say it was a Moog. I just think I'd had it in my head because it's such a weird farty bass sound.
Yeah.
More so than Think For Yourself.
Yes, plus, unlike Think For Yourself, this one just, it is just that one.
Yeah, there's no bass. No other bass is there to soften
it's
it.
It's not blended or kind of doubled or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, anything else production-wise to mention, do you think?
Not particularly, no. I think, as we say with a lot of Abbey Road, they've just got it down, haven't they? They've got the tracks they need, they've got the skills they need, and they've got the attitude they need to make these great-sounding records. And as always, Ringo comes across brilliantly because of that.
Yeah, this one's only suffering slightly because of its briefness, really, and there's not much else in it. And like some of the other kind of briefer parts of the medleys we have, but they have full orchestras and all sorts going on. So this is going to get 66 for production. Lyrics then. So this is where it definitely makes some points up, though, because we have one of John's jaunty characters this time, and not a Paul character, a John one. Another mister to join the ranks of Mr. Kite, Mr. Moonlight. Any other misters I've missed out, mister?
Not off the top of my head, although, of course, he didn't write Mr. Moonlight, so he's just adopted.
Okay, but it's always good to have a Mr. This or Mr. That kind of character song. These words are so good. You could imagine the likes of someone like John Cooper Clarke doing them, you know. Kind of like a spoken word type of like bawdy northern humour, kind of grotesque, bizarre character study. It, you know, really fits in with Polythene Pam, and which is actually, is that his sister Pam? I'm just
in the song it is. Yeah. Of course, in the original version, if you listen to the demo version, it's his sister Shirley.
Right.
So they made it Pam when they had Polythene Pam. So it's,
you know. I can't believe I'm nearly 40 years old and been listening to this music most of my adult life and before that, and I've only just realised that could be the same Pam.
Oh, there you go.
Who takes him out to look at the Queen whilst he shouts, you know, out something obscene. It's proper where. What did he think of this? Do we know?
I've not got the quote from Lennon, but I don't think he was one who carried it through, you know. It didn't burn a candle for it for the rest of his life. But of course, weird as it is, it comes from a real life story.
Okay.
So, let's see if I can blow your mind again.
Go on then.
Right. We know that Lennon liked to read the newspaper, and he'd always have the newspaper propped open somewhere, as he liked to have the TV on all the time, and we get these different influences on him. So this is in the Daily Mirror on the 7th of June 1967. There was a story about a divorce proceedings that has happened. Now, you can find this online. There's plenty of copies of it, obviously. I've got, rather than the Daily Mirror one, I've got one from the Daily Mail, which is an alternative telling of this thing. So the headline in the Daily Mail, Wednesday, 7th of June 1967. So a couple of years before this comes into being, or before this is recorded, at least. The headline is, Why Mr. Mustard Shaved in the Dark? And I'll read you the first paragraph. Civil servant John Mustard was so mean that he shaved, listened to the radio and went to bed in the dark, a judge said in the divorce court yesterday.
Right.
So this was Mr. Mustard, 65, of Old Parkview, Enfield, told the judge that he came from Scotland where carefulness was part of his upbringing. So basically he was a mean, stingy sod. And his wife divorced him because he gave her essentially about £1 to do the housekeeping for the entire year.
Right. Okay.
And he was, her husband punished her by silence. For the last year, the silence was almost total. The judge said Mr. Mustard was not vicious or unpleasant towards his wife in insisting on high standards of housekeeping. But he granted Mrs. Mustard a deputy headmistress, a decree nisi because of cruelty. So we basically never put the heating on. They listened to the radio in the dark because you didn't need to see anything, was his reasoning. So this stuck in John's head clearly, and it becomes one of the songs out of the, you know, the Rishikesh period, and ultimately ends up here with this twisted world of Lennon version.
Yeah, it's great. It's another one of those, very much like Paul's character songs, where you just get this kind of hints of a bigger story, kind of like this little microcosm of kind of what could be a bigger story. You just hear enough of it to kind of go to pique your interest and get your imagination going. But yeah, it's cool. Yeah, it's just penciling in the features, really. It's great. I'm going to give it 83 for lyrics, which gives it 68 overall. Next, Baby It's You.
Oh, many, many, many nights go by. I sit alone at home and I cry over you. What can I do?
Baby, it's you, Paul.
I'm a grown man, not a baby. A baby couldn't operate this complex podcasting equipment.
No, so right.
That's true. Anyway, it's a cover version from the very first album, Please Please Me, 22nd of March 1963, that comes out. Recorded in the mega Please Please Me session, which is the 11th of February 1963. With a couple of superimpositions on the 20th of February. And it's also worth mentioning, of course, that the BBC radio version of this that's on live at the BBC came out as a single in 1995, which actually got to number seven in the UK. So, which is interesting, because I think even at the time, I didn't know Please Please Me, the album, very well then. As it was one of the latest, one of the last ones I ever got. So suddenly for Baby It's You to be a single in the mid-90s, it's like, oh, I don't really know this. So it's an interesting little cover version on their first album, but then it's sort of representative of their live at the BBC type careers as well.
Yeah, I remember that whole thing, because was that leading Live at the BBC an anthology? Were they near to each other?
They weren't far apart, no.
Yeah, I remember this song being quite prominent, not really known why, but yeah. Not in a, like, because of the song, as in not knowing why suddenly that song was the one that was in the chart.
Yeah, I still don't know exactly why that was the one they picked from those tracks that ended up on the Live at the BBC album, but, you know, it's it's good.
Why not? It's nice.
And it's a good performance song of this song as well.
Yeah. I mean, the one we're going to rate is the Please Please Me one, but you know, it's I think it's much of a muchness, isn't it, really? So it's another R&B girl group kind of cover, isn't it?
Yeah, the Shirelles.
The Shirelles, which is my favourite type, I think. You know, I realised that this, doing the scores for this today, that I think out of all their covers, they've got the rock and roll ones, you know, the Carl Perkins kind of ones, and some of the country ones that more lean towards that. Then they've got the kind of R&B girl group type covers, and like Please Mr. Postman and this, and and maybe not all girl group ones, but also some of the other R&B stuff, like You Really Got a Hold of Me, and I think they're my bag. I think they're the ones I like the most of all, so I do like this very much. It's quite a straightforward bit of music in some senses, with the slow swing feel being the bedrock of that kind of this kind of heartbreak classic behind Lennon's best sultry vocals, I think, and the nice counterpoint backing of the you know, the finger-clicking, toe-tapping, swaying backing vocalists type of feel, with all their cheats and shalalas and all that stuff.
Yes.
I imagine John's delivery of this and the smouldering of it probably did him plenty of favours with the girls in the audience.
Yeah, well, it's one that they played alive. They played alive. They played it till it was alive. They played live quite a lot. It'd come out in 1961, originally, the Shirelles version.
Okay.
And that was a big hit for the Shirelles. It was number three on the R&B charts in America, number eight in the Hot 100. And their version is... I mean, they used it totally as the template for the Beatles version. They lifted it as much as they could, as accurately as they could, given their performance, you know, abilities and the instrumentation that they had available to them. So the vocal arrangement's very much like the Shirelles version, but obviously theirs is, you know, female Scouse vocals. No, yeah, when the Beatles is a different thing. But yeah, John's doing his best attempt to give it some soul.
Yeah, he does. I think he does it well, and I think the guys do a fun bit and back. It's just now and again when they say some of the words do come out very Scouse. Yeah, but yeah, I love a bit of all kind of Schopenhauer and all that stuff. And the solo is interesting, which I think we'll talk about in production as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to give it 54 for music. Production then. So obviously this is the first album, like I said, the one big day recording. So we have that lovely feeling of this being, you know, a proper take and them pretty much nailing it, I think. I know that this isn't their first one. I did a little bit of looking into this, but they didn't do many, did they?
No, and you've got to remember, this is towards the end of the session as well. So wow. they've got left to do after they finish Baby It's You is Twist and Shout. So John knows right. He's got the real screamer yet to come, but his voice has yeah. already been through hours and hours of singing.
So, yeah. Yeah, I think I read somewhere that you can someone saying you can hear it when he goes up a bit. I mean, you can a bit, but it suits the...
That's timbre and inflection anyway.
So. Yeah. So I can't pick up on many concessions to quality on this. I can't pick up on many kind of like, we'll let this, you know, time is short. It's the end of the night. You may have slipped up a bit there. I think they're pretty good all the way through. I can't think, are there any fluffs or issues that you've...
The only thing I think is that Ringo, who is normally absolutely metronomic, it slips a little bit in this. Okay. There's a little slip in the drumming tempo, but not much. You have to be really concentrating to spot it. But I think that's possibly why the BBC version was chosen as a single, because actually as a performance it's so close to this studio version, but in fact possibly a bit more solid.
Okay,
if a little pacier. I don't know. But obviously the BBC version doesn't have the nice overdubbed Celeste keys thing.
Ah, and that's what that is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that is an overdub, because I was going to say, what's doubling the guitar solo, and is it an overdub? Because I didn't realise that they did many overdubs on this session.
So that was added by George Martin on the 20th of February, so when I mentioned about superimpositions. So apparently he tried a piano version, adding a piano to this as well, but ended up not using it. But they ended up using the Celeste, so you get that lovely ringing bell sound. Whereas the Shirelles version has got an organ on it playing it's a beautifully little arranged thing. Like a little counterpoint thing. So it's a little Baroque sort of solo. Same thing in the tune of the solo, but the left hand's doing a little bit of sort of counterpoint runs. What people can't see here is I'm sort of playing it in the air in front of myself.
Yes, but it doesn't work on podcasts.
Yeah, but the volume on that organ solo on the Shirelles record is up much too loud, and it's very shrill. Whereas actually the twangy piano and Celeste twangy guitar and Celeste on the Beatles version is a nice pick.
Yes, it's it works well. So and also I like the reverb on this. There's quite a few on Please Please Me where I think they've gone a bit mad with it, and it perhaps doesn't work when there's a lot going on or it's loud and fast. I think the pace of this works with the reverb. The timbre of it works with the reverb.
Yeah, it's fair enough.
So I'm liking this one, and given that it's live and it's the end of a long day and that mad session overall, I think nothing detracts. I really like it. I'm going to give it 70 for production.
Ooh.
But because it's a cover, it doesn't get a lyric score. So we get 41.3 overall.
Right.
Okay. Next then, we have Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, Paul.
Huh. The initials are LSD.
What? Do you mean like the drug?
No, like pounds, shilling and pence, LSD.
Oh, okay.
Oh, sorry. That will be something I will mention and be grumpy about throughout this. I know. But yeah. So, a track from Sgt. Pepper, which comes out June 1967. This is another one that obviously, because it's in the Yellow Submarine film properly, unlike Think for Yourself, where it's just a snippet, this ends up on the Yellow Submarine song track as well in 1999. Yeah. This was recorded on the 28th of February 1967 and the 1st and 2nd of March. So, I mean, goodness knows where to start with this, really. I suppose the one thing I will say, if we've had Mean Mr. Mustard with John being as sort of low and languid as possible, we are with very speeded like almost cartoonish the other way vocals on this one.
Yeah.
To create this weird world.
Yes, definitely. We'll get onto a production. And, yeah, we can't cover it in the detail it needs to be. You know, there are plenty of places to do that. But, yeah, where to begin is definitely the thing that ran through my mind as well, trying to think of a way into talking about it. I mean, we can begin with the kind of haunting arpeggio that actually begins it.
Well, you think about this. So they start the recording sessions for Sgt. Pepper with Strawberry Fields, which, of course, has an iconic Mellotron intro. Yeah. And then we have Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. A couple of months later, they're recording this, and they've got another iconic keyboard-led intro. So it's clearly something they were trying out, and it works in both instances.
And what is the keyboard in this case? It's
a Lowry organ, but of course what you can do on those sorts of organs is you've got different settings, so you can combine settings. So you don't just have a switch that says bells and one switch that says strings and one switch that says blah, 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 blah. You can have several down at the same time to make these combination sounds.
Cool.
So this is a combination of settings on the Lowry organ.
That's a very good combination. Mm. Yeah, and it starts off and immediately puts us through the looking glass, doesn't it? You know, moments before John's voice comes in to kind of further take us like a phased Mad Hatter into that world of, you know, waltzing world. You know, our tour guide through this place he's taking us to, and when we actually get there, we have this bang and we move into 4/4 time. Because overall, this world is this vision of Lucy in the sky with diamonds. It's amazing musical journey. I love the bass in this, the passing notes, as simple as they are. When to move to the root, when to move to the, you know, a passing note on that descent, the staccato of the bridges, and then that classic kind of blues progression of the choruses. You know, you're blending, still quite rootsy rock and roll in the choruses, but because it comes as a relief to psychedelia, it makes them both those styles just change up, you know.
And you've got George adding in the tambora on top of it as well to add the wash of psychedelic colour.
Yeah,
and so you've got so much of Pepper bound up in this song, I think.
Yeah. And is it also George doubling up the bass in the choruses with the, because there's the kind of bass line is doubled on the guitar, isn't it, as well?
Yeah, yeah, it is.
Yeah, for added oomph.
Yeah, and there's lots of effects going onto the guitar as well to give it all sorts of different weird sounds.
So that's the thing, it's got a bedrock of kind of the bass and the drums, because above that you've got this kind of things washing in and out in a good way, you know, a bit of that organ sound, and then the George on his, what was it again?
Tambora.
On his tambora, kind of coming in and out and changing up and stuff. It's great effect. And the double vocals and the way the guitar doubles with the vocals as well, doesn't it? So when he says, take you away, the bends are happening on the guitar as well.
Yeah, and again, George was doing that with an eye on the way Indian performances often happen, in that you would have a certain instrument will double up a vocal line. So he's taken that and used his electric guitar to do that technique there.
Mm.
So it's not just the tambora in as a sort of Indian influence.
There's a lot of George in this, actually. There's a lot of George influence going on in this. Yeah, and Ringo is pretty much keeping the beat here. He's not doing too much, because he's got to really mark that change. And that, with that thumping bass drum part, apart from being functional, I imagine, for the band, it's also a great way to do it. That, you know, leading into the tempo change. And of course, there's the vocals, not just John's melody, but all the harmonies and the choruses. And I'm sure it's a production thing to talk about, but his delivery of it is... Yeah, his performance of it, beyond just being able to sing it, you know, is fantastic. It's great. It's awesome, frankly. So I'm going to give it 93 for music. Mm. Production then. So there's one thing I'm going to point out before we talk. I'm going to point out the one mistake I can hear.
Is it when there's just another vocal noise after he finishes one line?
He sounds like he's going to sing high again after he's just said incredibly high.
Yeah.
he sings incredibly high, and then he goes,
ha. Yeah.
And then it kind of cuts off, and it's like, oh, what? They've left that in then. But other than that, it's all just great stuff to talk about, isn't it? We've phased drums up throughout.
Well, there's all sorts of stuff. Everything's getting a bit of a treatment via the various things that they've invented or they've got available to them in the studio. So, yeah, everything's getting a bit of phasing and flanging going on.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. So the drums, I can hear that particularly. Everything else, yes, is happening, but it's unusual. It's more unusual to hear it on the drums. But, you know, a nice phased snare drum can be a very cool thing, can't it? But it definitely rings out and adds to that dream quality. And, yeah, as does the vari-speed vocal, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so that's...
I'm not guessing, you told me.
Yeah, but they've slowed it down. John's recorded his vocal so that when it returns to pitch, it sounds more peculiar, sounds... I wouldn't say it doesn't sound more childlike, but it sounds... It just changes the tonal quality of the voice. We've talked about this before, it's really on show in this song more than any other. So it almost gets to the point where they're pushing it, like I say, slightly cartoony.
Yeah.
You know, it starts because of... Well, let's not go into the physics of it. But anyway, yeah, it's clearly on display in this. But it's another great feature of it.
And then there's the reverb. I mean, there's reverb and there's reverb. And there's the reverb that and the way they've swelled, you know, they swell it on this just at the right time. And the way that the chorus vocals, the harmony vocals join, the reverb's pushed up. And then it rings out as other sections are coming in. And it's just warm and all-encompassing without being, you know, it's brilliant. It's just brilliant, the kit they were using that. I imagine all very analogy and kind of valves and things going on. I imagine it just sounds great.
Yeah, and physical manipulation of the tape to make a lot of these sort of wiry, flangy effects going on as well.
I mean, technically, there's so much going on, more than we were going to talk about, and much that can be covered in all sorts of literature and other podcasts and whatnot. But what matters to us and to me is that it all comes together to create this psychedelic masterpiece. I suppose, unlike other ones we've covered, there's not a great deal of other accompaniment beyond the things we've talked about and lots of studio trickery, for want of a better word, you know, studio work, studio as an instrument, in the best possible sense, to make what is there very dreamy and ascendant, almost. So I'm going to give it 90.5 for production.
Yeah, big George will appreciate that.
Yeah. So on to the lyrics. I mean... I don't know if you've noticed, Paul, but do you want to set aside the LSD thing instantly?
Yes, let's get it out of the way. Right? Okay. Yes, you can find the initials LSD in Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. Okay. Why we have to keep having this debate of people denying Lennon's denial and McCartney's denial and all this stuff. Okay, yeah. I am not saying that they weren't taking LSD, and I'm not saying that in terms of what it does for your, or what potentially can do for your approach to things, I'm not saying that's not there and not relevant and not in the mix for the whole of this period particularly.
Yeah.
It is, okay? But the fact is, why would John make up this story about Julian bringing home a drawing with the name written on it, Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds? Why would he make it up?
Because he doesn't. They've openly talked about the drugs in other parts of their career in music and stuff. It's what,
you know, and this is and they know who Lucy was. This is Lucy O'Donnell who went to school with Julian Lennon. This is we know who this person is. Why do we? You know, he didn't look at it and go, ah, thanks, kid. It says LSD for me there. You know, he didn't do that. It's.
I think the thing is that even if
drives me mad.
I suppose that it's also about that argument kind of doesn't really talk about motivation. So even if he thought, oh, I'm going to write a sneaky song about LSD based on the initials, to come up with the Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds out of thin air and construct all this would have been genius anyway.
Yeah. And you've got you've got the Alice in Wonderland thing in there as well, which he talks about. He says, you know, because he's always talked about liking Alice in Wonderland and all that stuff there. And so he's using that. He's just merging a load of stuff together, which he was perfectly capable of. stone cold sober from any of this stuff. Yeah. So why, you know.
To be honest, Paul, when people take LSD, they spend half the time just staring at the carpet, not writing great lyrics. So, like, I think, you know, they're just people to shoehorn that in. But either way, to me, it's brilliant anyway. It's either a prompt from a child's drawing, which is great, but also doesn't give him the rest of the lyrics. He had to do that. And, or, you know, even if he wanted to say it was because he wanted to hide LSD in a song, he'd still have to write the whole lyrics, whether he wrote it on them or not is stupid. Really.
I think it's just partly because the notion of LSD is that it was such a weird drug and it would drive you crazy. You would jump off buildings. You'd think you could fly. You would see other universes. So it's a very, you know, in terms of the media portrayal of it, people find it very weird and freaky. And it is weird and freaky. There's no doubt about it. But it can't be the be-all and end-all of something this great that is made by humans.
Yeah, at the end of the day, it's still opening up a brain that was already there or whatever. But anyway, the prompt, Lucy in the Sky of Diamonds, wherever it came from, does not the whole song make. What makes the song is the cellophane flowers, the marmalade skies, the rocking horse people, and the general Lewis Carollery. Carollery.
Nice try at making up a word.
Lewis Corollary, I wanted to say. It sounds like it should be a word. But also not, too, because he's not just copying that. He's making it his own. He's using that idea, that feeling, to create like his own adjacent world to that. For some reason, when I listen to this, all the kind of happy, hippie, psychedelic stuff just feels right and compelling and interesting and cool. Whereas, to be honest, when I listen to things like The Piper at the Gate of Dawn, like we talked about in our last bonus episode, that stuff sounds silly and fairly ridiculous. This somehow doesn't to me. I don't know if it's because I'm biased because I've been brought up listening to the Beatles. But when I listen to other stuff that's a bit kind of like tiptoeing around in the daisies of night, all that stuff, it just sounds stupid.
No, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. And it's
funny and I don't mind it. And I like the daftness of it. This doesn't sound daft to me. It doesn't sound like Austin Powers, you know, idea of 60s psychedelia. It just sounds like imaginative stuff, you know, imaginative stuff.
That
even
was a very interesting pronunciation of imaginative.
Imaginative. It perhaps doesn't have the emotional resonance of some of his other songs because I do feel it's just about, oh, this is a cool psychedelic scene. I'm going to take us through it tonight. It's an interesting idea and I'm just going to explore it. So I don't think it's laden with metaphor or anything like that. So in some ways, it doesn't score maybe as highly as something that blends all that as well. So I'm going to give it 88 for lyrics, which gives it 90.5 overall. Leaves gap for Paul comment. Doesn't get one?
No.
Hang on, what's that?
It's the Ruttles, and it's a track from the original soundtrack album. It's Good Times Roll. Hour after hour in an ivory tower, a thousand and nothings to do. Spending the day in a colourful way, blue upon blue. Perfect parody of Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds that's got it's a brilliant example. I keep saying it, I feel like I'm just saying the same thing every time and I don't mind saying it over and over again, of Neil Innes doing the job he needed to do in such a brilliant way, because he's not just having to work up some music and then just cram in some She Loves You, type stuff or whatever it is, or just some, like you say, nonsense psychedelia. What he manages to do is also manage to shove in loads of brilliantly funny and brilliantly clever psychedelic lyrics into it. So he's not just doing one job or the other. He hasn't got someone else bringing words in. He's written Good Times Roll. You know, it contains the word psychedelicatessen. And somehow, to me, again, Good Times Roll doesn't quite veer into that ludicrous, bizarre, you know, pastiche 60s weirdness that people do, even though it is very silly. It's, I don't know, it's just, I can't fault it.
Yeah, it's great. It's another. There's no denying this one's a Lucy in the Sky pastiche.
Oh yeah, there's no two ways about it.
Not one of those ones where it's a few things really blended. This is pretty much just doing Lucy in the Sky, isn't it? I think. But yeah, I like how the bassist is also doing a very good Paul impression in this, as he is whoever that does the bass is in most of them, as is the vocal with the weirdly recorded lead vocal. You know, they've got all that stuff right on the nose, haven't they? Yeah. And it's got a nice funky chorus too.
Yeah, I mean the words in this, and plus it's also got that line, the children of rock and roll never grow old, they just fade away, which again is one of those Neil lines that makes me feel sort of like, oh, that's heartbreaking. You know, he's writing this in the late 70s about a band that came and went, that his friends in, and, you know, and it says so much about how much the Beatles mean through the channel of the Ruttles and this song.
Yeah. Very good. Okay, then, let's go on with our last song, which is You Can't Do That.
Well, it's the second time I caught you talking to him. Do I have to tell you one more time? I think it's a sin. I think I let you down. Let you down. I leave you flat. Gonna let you down and leave you flat. Because I told you before, oh, you can't do that. Everybody's green.
You can't do that, Paul.
Oh, I washed my hands.
Well, you just can't.
Okay, I'll stop. Right. You Can't Do That is a song from the B-side of Can't Buy Me Love, the single, which comes out on the 20th of March 1964. It's also on the Hard Day's Night record, which comes out in July 1964. And it's recorded on the 25th of February 1964. It's a song then that, because it features on the Hard Day's Night record, they play it live all the way through 1964 and all those shows as well. And it is one of the few examples of a John Lennon guitar solo.
Ah.
So, yeah. Great song.
Yeah. Cool stuff. Yeah, I like the riff this is based around, you know, the kind of the main riff that brings it in. And
so it's George's sort of 12-string guitar making itself known.
Yeah, it's kind of an edgy seventh, kind of making it kind of sound jaunty and irregular, isn't it? Lots of sevenths going on. Makes it a bit more interesting for what is, in essence, for a large part of it, kind of a rocker, isn't it? Not all the way. It's not a straightforward 12-bar-y thing, but it's got that feel to it. But it's one of the things that marks it out a bit more. The chorus helps us also to break that mould a bit, though, which I will always remember the chorus, because when we were little, Paul, this is one of the ones we had on a tape, isn't it?
Well, we had... our Beatles collection was our mums. I think it's mainly mums, not mum and dad. I think it was mainly mums. Some LPs from which were released on the German Odeon label because they bought one. They were stationed in Germany, and a handful of cassettes. One was Sgt. Pepper. One was Hard Day's Night. I think we had the Hey Jude compilation as well. That was before we started buying, I started getting the cassettes myself. But yes, we had Hard Day's Night on tape.
And everybody was green.
Yes. Well, that's my note for lyrics, is that basically it was our next door but one neighbour, Mark Hardwick. We were listening to this and he found the line, everybody's green, so funny. And so I think I always basically knew what it meant, as in green with envy. But I think he just in his mind, he'd gone, everybody's green.
I think I don't remember that, but I remember not... just having an image in my mind of people being green or being sick.
Oh, right, yeah.
Probably more from reading Buster and things, where people go green when they're about to be sick, not really knowing about envy and things, but not really thinking to ask either. but anyway, apart from that lyric, the bass is doing some cool stuff too, sticking to the root and then doing some fast little flurries here and there. Yeah. He does some proper little funky, very quick kind of up and down the scaly bits. It's got great energy, and I think it's bordering on single quality when it comes to the kind of foot tappingness of it and the general drive and fun. I don't know whether maybe its theme lets it down.
Yeah, well, I think you might be right. I mean, when you consider it's the flip side of Can't Buy Me Love, it's not as good as Can't Buy Me Love.
No.
But it's, you wouldn't be sad turning that disc over. You wouldn't be thinking, oh, this is just a throwaway B-side. This is, it's a good song.
It is a good song. I'm going to give it 59 for music.
Yeah, and it's got a very loud cowbell in it.
Yes, it has, which I don't hate. Which, anyway, we'll talk about that now. Production. So I was going to say, about after 27 weeks of doing this, I'm going to guess that it's a 12-string playing it, but you've already confirmed that for me, so I've already given myself a pat on the back for that. It works really well, a 12-string on this, for that riff. And as you were just saying, I also love the cowbell, which isn't something I'd often say. It almost feels tuned.
Well, you know what I mean? Yeah. I do know what you mean. They would have been out select from a couple of different ones. In fact, if you read the Beatles recording reference manuals, I think he speculates on which brand and model of cowbell it would be. There's obviously different sizes of cowbells have different resonances, and therefore, sort of, it sometimes feels like they've got an implied tone to them. Anyway, it's great.
This one really fits the track. Sometimes they can be a bit a bit like the tambourine of percussion. Sorry, that's silly.
The cowbell is the tambourine of percussion. That makes no sense whatsoever.
A bit like the tambourine in that, sometimes it can be like, oh, it's a bit much. Mm. But no, this works well.
And there's bongos in there as well, so there's all sorts of things keeping it moving.
Okay. Cool. The bass is great. The thickness of the vocals in the chorus really gives it a push.
Yeah. And one thing in production is that they're using 4-track by this point.
Okay.
And they're starting to use it well, rather than just being, oh, I've got a bit more space to capture stuff. They're thinking a bit more about how they can space stuff out on here and what can how can they use it to overlay things. So I think it benefits from the fact that this was made in 64 rather than, say, the year before, for instance. So,
I'd say it was if it were an album track, it'd be one of the really good ones. But
it is an album track. Definitely. It is an album track as well as the B-side, so.
Oh, is it on the album
too? Yeah, it is on Hard Day's Night record.
Oh, yes. Yeah, of course it is. So, it's a really good album track. It's just the lyrics that we'll talk about next, but it's 63 for production, I'm going to give it.
Solid.
So, lyrics, I think it's been a little while since we've had one of these dodgy lyrics songs, really. I mean, it's slightly more ambiguous this time because, if the she of this kind of the subject of this song was perhaps talking to this other fella all the time and kind of draped over him and making suggestive comments, then maybe you'd have a point, if it was that kind of situation. However, given some of his other jealousy-based songs, you get more the feeling that she's simply just talking to other men at all and that he doesn't want her to do that. You know, it's not spelled out enough that, the thing she's doing, the him she's talking to is anything that's genuinely worth his concern. You can't really get that from the song. So, do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. Yeah. And it's a Lennon jealousy song.
Yeah.
Which obviously is something that it's a theme that crops up now and again, either with him just expressing it or examining it, depending on when he's writing.
But as I say, it's ambiguous enough not to feel as mean as some of the others because, there could be genuine times where that would be an actual concern, but you don't really get to glean that from the song.
Yeah, it does feel more like it's just in the mode of songs of the period rather than perhaps indicative of a more terrifying, deep-seated, personal problem.
Yeah. And anyway, we get to hear about all the green people running around feeling sick or being aliens or whatever they are. I'm going to give it 41 for lyrics, so that gives it 54.3 overall. So there we go. The final scores. We have one that has hit the top 10. And the others are as follows. Out of 135 songs, Baby It's You goes in very high for a cover at number 109. You Can't Do That goes in at 75th. Think For Yourself is number 53, and Mean Mr. Mustard is joint 50th with Taxman. So let's have a listen to the top 10. At number 10, we have Nowhere Man. Blackbird at number 9. Yesterday at number 8. The Fool on the Hill is number 7. Cry Baby Cry at number 6. Lady Madonna at number 5. Let It Be at number 4. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds at number 3. I Am the Walrus at number 2. And Strawberry Fields Forever at number 1. Just nudging lovely Rita out there to number 11.
Interesting. There's still movement up the top end of the charts.
There is, and there's still plenty of potential for more.
Yes.
Join us next week and find out if that's when it happens. Okay, thanks again, Paul.
That's all right. That's what I'm here for.
And thanks for listening. Bye.
Tambourines!
Oh, no. Stop it.